From California to Maryland, North Carolina to Montana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the United States has a new trade agreement with Mexico, and negotiations with Canada continue. Dan Griswold from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here with details. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has supercharged the U.S. economy, and there are plans for Tax Cuts 2.0. Will they happen, or will politics get in the way? Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders has come up with yet another plan for taxing major employers. Eric Boehm and Zuri Davis of Reason Magazine report. And the economy is booming, but rapidly increasing state spending is keeping many states from replenishing their rainy day funds. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Trump administration has successfully concluded a new trade agreement with Mexico to replace NAFTA, the North American Trade Agreement, and talks with Canada continue. Here to talk about the new trade landscape is Dan Griswold. Dan is Senior Research Fellow and Co-Director of the Program on the American Economy and Globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Dan, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Dan, the Trump administration has arrived at a new trade agreement with Mexico, this to replace NAFTA, and we'll talk about the Canadian portion of it a little later. Tell us a little bit about the new deal with Mexico. Why is it better than the old? How is it better than the old?
Well, in some ways it's better. In some ways it's a step back. On the positive side, zero tariffs were preserved, and that's the foundation of any free trade agreement. And we keep zero tariffs on trade both ways. That's great. It updates NAFTA. NAFTA is almost 25 years old, so it has a digital trade chapter that talks about the freedom to locate servers wherever, free data flows, something called the de minimis threshold. That's the threshold under which customs doesn't inspect or impose duties on packages. That's very important to small and medium-sized companies that are shipping products to customers overseas. Mexico's agreed to raise theirs to $100, which is a good start. Ours is $800, but this is a good thing. It has enhanced protections for intellectual property, and in particular in the agricultural area, to ensure that things like genetically modified organisms are not restricted from trade. They pose no health standards, but sometimes regulations are used as disguised trade barriers. And there was something called a sunset clause that the Trump administration wanted. That is not part of this agreement. There's something about reviewing it in 6 years, but it doesn't come to kind of an automatic end. And I think that's good. So that's the positive side. On the downside, and this is significant, it does have labor and environmental chapters, which I don't think need to be in trade agreements. They shouldn't be in trade agreements. They're separate issues. Trade enhances labor rights and gives governments the resources to implement environmental policies. And so I think that's extraneous, and it's not clear it's going to win any Democratic support. The biggest problem with the renegotiated NAFTA with Mexico is the rules of origin on automobiles. That's the minimum amount of North American content that a car has to have to qualify for zero duty treatment. Under the current NAFTA, it's 62.5%. That's actually pretty high, pretty strict for a trade agreement, regional trade agreement. This would take it up to 75%. And 40 to 45%, depending on whether it's a passenger car or a truck, would have to be from labor that's getting paid $16 an hour or more, i.e. from the United States or Canada, and non-Mexican labor. Two-thirds, 70% of Mexican vehicles already qualify under these rules, but it would force some of the supply chain to come back to the United States, or they'd just ignore it and import the cars at the 2.5% duty to the United States. The bottom line is the North American supply chain will be somewhat less efficient. U.S. automakers, their costs will go up. The price of cars will go up for American consumers. And our cars will be less competitive in global markets. To me, that's not a step forward. That's a step back. But by and large, most of NAFTA is intact with Mexico. Canada's left out, and of course that's the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Is Canada going to be part of the deal? But strictly with Mexico, pluses and minuses, but the essential NAFTA is left intact, and I think that's a good thing.
Overall, on balance, Dan, would you say that this puts the United States in a better position? Because the president railed against NAFTA during the campaign, kept saying, I can negotiate a better deal. So yeah. Is this overall, on balance, a better deal?
That's a hard one to answer. We dodged a bullet. Withdrawing from NAFTA would have been a disaster. We're not going to do that, apparently. So that's a good thing. I don't think this leaves us in a better position overall. It slightly weakens the benefits of NAFTA by making the integrated North American manufacturing platform a little less appealing, a little less efficient. So what the administration did is cut back on some of the benefits of NAFTA, leaving the essential agreement in place. I don't think that was an overall improvement, but it's not abandoning the agreement either. So under the current conditions, I think we can make this work.
Let's talk then for a minute about Canada. Canada not part of this U.S.-Mexican agreement. Of course, Canada was part of NAFTA. Those talks are ongoing. How important is it for the United States, and how important is it for Canada that ultimately they be included in the new agreement?
It is hugely important. It's essential that Canada be part of any final agreement, and really unthinkable that they would be left out. One, Canada is our number one export market. I mean, 30 million people in Canada, and they buy more U.S. exports than any other country in the world, goods and services. A strong ally across the board, and trade is tied up with things like security. And so it's very important. They're our number one source of energy in terms of imported crude oil. So, and when you look at the automotive sector, the U.S. and the Canadian automobile sectors are pretty much fully integrated. We've actually had, while NAFTA is 25 years old, we've actually for more than 50 years had an agreement with Canada to integrate our automotive sectors. And then, of course, you remember we had a separate U.S.-Canada free trade agreement that went into effect in 1988, and then Mexico joined, and we renamed it NAFTA in 1994. So we have closely integrated economies. It's hugely important for the United States. It's even more important for Canada in the sense that their relative dependence on the United States is greater, and how could it not be here? We're a $20 trillion economy on their southern doorstep. So we need to do this, and then politically, I don't think Congress is going to support just a bilateral agreement with Mexico. More than 30 states look to Canada as their number one export market. It's hugely important to U.S. agriculture. We sell $20 billion worth of agricultural products to Canada each year. So we have to include Canada. Frankly, I don't understand the president's animosity towards Canada. It seems all out of proportion. We actually have pretty much balanced trade with them. When you take goods and services, it's about even, and that's not important to me or most economists, but it is important to the president. I wonder if it's just kind of his negotiating style, right? He makes you seem like you're the enemy until you strike a deal, and then you're his best friend, and we may see that with Canada. We kind of saw it with Mexico.
We have been talking with Dan Griswold, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Dan, tell us just a little bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, where on the web can folks go to get more information?
Yes, the Mercatus Center is a nonprofit affiliated with George Mason University here in Northern Virginia. You can find all our work at mercatus.org.
Dan Griswold of the Mercatus Center. Dan, thank you for being back with us.
Thank you.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth has been keeping an eye on a wide range of interesting developments over the past week. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
We are off to a very fast post-Labor Day start here. We have a number of topics to talk about today, but let's start out Tax Cuts 2.0. Republicans have been talking about adding on to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, perhaps making the tax cuts permanent. What sort of developments over the last week or so?
When they passed the tax bill back in 2017, a lot of the provisions were temporary, and that was by design in order to meet the conditions for reconciliation. They couldn't make all of the tax cuts permanent, which is unfortunate, but that's the way it goes. The corporate tax cut was made permanent, but the tax cuts for individuals was not, as was several other things, like the alternative minimum tax, getting rid of that, and a few other things. So Tax Cuts 2.0 is designed as the next logical step to that initial bill to finish what they started, to make all these temporary things permanent. Republicans wanted to do this right before the election to put Democrats in a tight spot. If Democrats can't make middle-class tax cuts permanent, then that will be really revealing to the voters. What's unfortunate, though, is that there is now a sense that GOP leaders will not have a vote ahead of the elections. And the reason why is that one of the provisions that is temporary is the state and local tax deduction. And without getting too far into the weeds, that is a tax deduction that Republicans got rid of in the initial bill. It's a huge giveaway to state and local governments. It basically allows local and state governments to spend more money than they otherwise would and put the bill or the expense of that extra spending on the back of the federal government. Getting rid of it was very good policy.
There have been a number of political developments this past week. There was a primary election in Massachusetts, which normally, Andy, we wouldn't pay a whole lot of attention to because it's a one-sided state. However, the war, internal war, that the Democrats seem to be having between their establishment and their ultra-left fringe has resurfaced. What happened?
Yeah, I think a lot of voters know that there is a very active civil war within the Republican Party, but you're now seeing the radical left tried to take over the Democrat Party. We saw that in New York, where a 28-year-old woman, a former bartender, comes out of nowhere and beats a sitting incumbent congressman in the Democrat primary. That just happened again in Massachusetts, where a Boston City councilwoman, an Air Force veteran, she came out of nowhere, didn't have a lot of money in the bank, and beat a 20-year incumbent. And it's all because she is selling voters on a very radical, progressive agenda. And so Democrats are gravitating further and further to the left, and they're really upsetting the Democrat establishment. It's a remarkable thing to witness, and frankly, it's a little bit scary because these folks are not trying to just raise taxes and spend a little bit more. They're trying to reshape and transform America's identity into something that is just absolutely horrible. They want to turn this country into a full-blown socialist utopia. And I hope that general election voters recognize the threat that that is and rejects it whole cloth. But the civil war within the Democrat Party is very alive and well, and I think it's going to continue for a while.
Across the country, in Arizona, of course, the funeral for John McCain is now over, and the governor of Arizona, Governor Ducey, has appointed somebody to his seat. Tell us who and what impact that might have.
I don't know if it was a surprise or not. I guess everybody kind of knew it could happen, but I guess it's a little surprising that it happened. But Governor Ducey, a Republican, appointed former Senator John Kyle to replace McCain. John Kyle is one of those strange creatures of D.C. where he's able to work closely with the establishment, yet still have a fairly conservative record. And he retired back in 2012, I believe. And I think he's since been a lobbyist, which is unfortunate. But Ducey is looking for somebody to just replace McCain just for the remainder of McCain's term, and then somebody else will presumably run in 2020 for the full length of the next term. And John Kyle, I think everyone saw him as a non-controversial caretaker for this seat. In fact, it's kind of odd in his statement where he accepts the nomination or accepts the appointment. He said that he can guarantee that he'll be in that seat for at least a year, but maybe two. So it's not a foregone conclusion that he'll even fulfill this seat's term through 2020. It may be 2019. But he'll be a good vote. People are starting to talk about maybe bringing up Obamacare repeal because McCain was the deciding vote, and John Kyle is decidedly much more conservative than McCain. So perhaps they have the votes now to do it. I don't know if the calendar will allow them to attempt it before the election, but they could signal that they will repeal Obamacare if they are able to keep the Senate majority after November, which I think they will.
We also will point out there were hearings this past week for Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh. We're sort of out of time to talk about today. So next week, Andy, I'd like to get into the timetable for when that confirmation might occur. In the interim, tell us a little bit about the Club for Growth.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
No level of taxation is enough for Bernie Sanders, who apparently stays awake at night coming up with new ways to tax the productive sector. With details on his latest plan to take money from major employers, we have this report from Eric Boehm and Zuri Davis of Reason Magazine.
Is Amazon.com just simply too successful? That's what Bernie Sanders seems to think, and he's produced new legislation that would specifically target companies like Amazon for higher taxes. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Zuri Davis. She is an assistant editor at Reason.com and a colleague of mine, and this is her first time on the show, so a warm welcome to you, Zuri. Thanks so much for taking some time and being here and joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal.
Thank you for having me today.
So, Zuri, you have a piece up this week at Reason.com, and Zuri is a very prolific writer for us, but one of your pieces this week is about this proposal from Senator Bernie Sanders that is, as you put it in the headline, Zuri, his latest hit against Amazon. I don't think our listeners need much of an introduction to Sanders or to his general political views, but tell us, what is his latest big idea?
So his latest idea is an act that's called the Stop Bad Employers by Zeroing Out Subsidies Act, which if you put all those last words together, it spells out the Stop Bezos Act. So basically he's proposing a 100% tax on big companies like Amazon and Walmart to pay for the government assistance that any of their employees are on.
This whole idea that he's pushing really has its roots in an argument that we hear periodically from the left and sometimes actually from the right, too, but mostly from the left. And the argument is that big corporations just don't pay high enough wages. And if they don't pay their workers enough, then their workers have to go beyond government welfare programs just to get by, and that this is a problem. And if it's true, certainly it would be a problem. This is something I remember years ago. Walmart was really the big target of this line of attack, and now Walmart isn't really so much in vogue, I guess, as Amazon, so Amazon is the new one. But the idea that people who work for these hugely successful businesses aren't being paid enough to stay off welfare programs, is there any truth to that basic claim that that kind of underlines this entire idea?
Well, so his argument, he's basically accusing Jeff Bezos himself of being subsidized by the government. And it's this weird kind of roundabout thinking of how he gets to that conclusion. But when he first started talking about Amazon on Facebook and Twitter, Amazon actually responded with a press release of their own, and they explained that, one, they do pay their associates living wages, so they pay on average $15 an hour for the warehouse workers. They also offer paid family leave and flexible leave options for new parents. They have like a comprehensive benefit package that includes health insurance, disability, all that. And they basically said that some of the figures that Bernie Sanders was looking at included people that didn't actually work at Amazon anymore. And it included part-time people who chose to be part-time and did other things like for the rest of the week, like on their own time. So perhaps there's some truth to it, I guess, that there were different figures being used, but as it stands right now, the numbers are a little bit misleading.
Yeah. I mean, obviously he's being a little bit selective here in what he's choosing to look at. But I think even if you step back a little further and you're trying to see the whole picture, but I mean, I think you still can miss something here, because even if you step back and look at the whole picture of what workers at Amazon are earning, you're still kind of missing the fact that these companies, the Walmarts and the Amazons of the world, they are providing a lot of value that just doesn't get reflected on the balance sheet. I mean, I can order something now and have it brought to my door in less than 48 hours, and usually at significantly lower cost than what I might have to pay to get it from a traditional store. And that buying power that I have and you have and everyone has, that doesn't really get captured in simple black and white terms. But really, in a lot of ways, Amazon has made us all better off, and that includes the people who work there.
For sure. And there's one thing that happened in the recent year. Amazon actually started like a driving program where drivers could kind of create like their own local network. So there are lots of opportunities that Amazon is creating for people that kind of gets ignored because of this argument that because Jeff Bezos is worth so many millions of dollars, it's not fair that other people make less than him, which is going to happen regardless.
Yeah, I mean, in short, you can only eat the rich for so long, right? That's the lesson here. We are talking with Zuri Davis from Reason.com. She's a friend and a colleague of mine, and she is here to talk to us about Bernie Sanders' new proposal to target Amazon for higher taxes. Zuri, not a lot of time left here, but I do also want to touch on how Amazon seems to be getting hit from both sides at the moment. We've got President Donald Trump, for reasons that are probably more personal than political. He's been attacking Jeff Bezos and Amazon as well. So you've really got both the right and the left going after Amazon for being, I don't know, I guess too successful, too profitable, giving too many people the things that they want. Is that a fair assessment?
For sure. And it's definitely a lot of misinformation, but on top of that, bad ideas about economics and bad ideas about how businesses work.
No doubt about that. Definitely a poor understanding of economics all around, right and left. That is very true. And it's really particularly disheartening, I think, to see these attacks when they come from the right. You know, I kind of expect it from Sanders and his crowd, but I really am surprised when I see conservatives taking up this same or a similar line of attack. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. That is Zuri Davis, assistant editor at Reason.com. Zuri, thanks for taking some time and being here.
Thank you.
And again, you can check out Zuri's work at Reason.com. Check out her newest piece on Bernie Sanders and Amazon up there. And as I said, she's a very prolific writer. Lots of good stuff from Zuri. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bain. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Rather than take advantage of a growing economy to reduce expenses and put money away to weather future recessions, many states are on a spending spree. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains why this is a recipe for disaster on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Unemployment in the United States is approaching historic lows, and our economy is unarguably a full employment economy. Consumer confidence in personal consumption expenditures have improved since 2009. Business investment and sentiment have improved, and net exports are improving partially in light of renegotiated trade agreements. With three of the four components of gross domestic product stabilizing significantly, only government spending and deficit financing are questionable components of the economy. State tax revenues from higher income taxes in an improving economy and increasing sales tax due to increasing consumer spending should be expected to produce massive state surpluses. This hypothesis, if validated, would signify that the United States is potentially on the road to financial recovery for all components of the economy, with the exception of the federal deficit. The primary sources of income for most states are income tax, sales tax, and property taxes. In a 2017 report from Pew Trust, using data from the National Association of State Budget Offices, NASBO, indicates that 31 states are facing budget shortfalls, and the rainy day funds for most states are woefully inadequate or even non-existent to withstand a recession. All of this is despite the improving national economy. Unfortunately, concurrent with the increasing revenues for the states, spending has also continued to explode, resulting in limited to no improvement in the financial condition at the state level. The implication is that the states are spending all the increased income that is coming in from the improving economy with no measurable improvement in the state's financial condition. This lack of long-term financial planning is a recipe for disaster. To get a comprehensive perspective of the condition of the state's finances requires an individual with significant financial expertise to sort through the CAFR, which is the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. This massive document is now required for all public entities. All states prepare this annual report. The machinations and complexity of state financial reporting and the requirement to balance the budget by whatever means hides the real risks and spending excesses by the states. Despite the CAFR's intended purpose of improving clarity in state financing, the ability of states to use special funds, record unrealistically high expected earnings rates on pension obligations, use debt financing to skim over budget deficits, and failing to record post-employment health care costs of the state retirees all limits the validity of this financial report. Efforts are underway, such as with GASB 75, which requires recording of post-employment benefits to improve financial reporting, but a great deal must be done yet. Upon examination of the comprehensive annual financial reports for the majority of states, it becomes painfully apparent that the states have squandered a substantially improving economy by increasing spending rather than by improving their financial condition. Complicating the analysis that government's financial reports still fail to adequately disclose financial condition. This lack of transparency helps mask the severity of the crisis. For instance, in Pennsylvania, the governor celebrated transferring $22 million into the rainy day fund, despite borrowing $1.5 billion in order to fund the payment. This failure to substantially replenish rainy day funds, pay down pension obligations, pay down debt, and to prepare for a future recession will wreak havoc during the next recession. I would anticipate that such states as Illinois, Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and California will find themselves in need of a federal bailout, or they will become insolvent. Only by improving transparency, limiting state government spending growth, and reporting state debt service exclusive of the operating budgets of the states will states begin to come to grips with the financial crisis they are in. The tremendous improvement in the economy since 2016 should begin to result in reduced social expenditures due to the improved economy, but it has not. Instead, states have continued increasing spending for virtually every component of the budget, including social safety net programs, which defies logic. Just as in 2000 we found that earnings do matter, in 2008 we came to understand that no documentation loans were unsound at every level, in 2018 we have to recognize that no state is too big to fail. In 2000, the tech industry led the financial crisis. In 2008, the housing industry and the out-of-control financial industry led us into a near depression. In 2018, states that failed to heed their financial responsibilities to their citizens and our nation may well lead us into a financial disaster of unparalleled proportions. Transparency, spending reductions, and reducing debt service will keep our nation from falling victim to financially irresponsible state fiscal budgets. It's not too late for the states to live up to their responsibilities to all of us. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include WTUZ-FM in New Philadelphia, Ohio, WCRA-AM in Effingham, Illinois, along with WCVR-AM in Randolph, Vermont. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.